Thanks for tuning in for the April 6th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's feature interview with Jade Smith focuses on financial conflicts of interest of authors who published papers in high-impact neurology journals in 2016. For our What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Dr. Emily Largent on potential advancements and ethical challenges associated with blood testing for Alzheimer's disease.
This is Stacey Clarney, and today I'm speaking with Jade Smith. She's a researcher who conducted the work we'll discuss at Dartmouth College, and more recently, she's been working at Mass General. She'll soon actually change paths and matriculate to medical school, so I'm glad that we've gotten a hold of Jade to talk to her before she changes paths. So Jade is the author of a paper in this week's issue of Neurology. It's titled Financial Conflicts of Interest of U.S.-Based Authors in Neurology Journals, a Cross-Sectional Study Using the Open Payments Database. Jade, I was really glad to see this paper come across the title list for the journal this week because this is a really important issue, especially to earn the trust of our colleagues and more importantly, our patients. We obviously need to be transparent with any perceived conflicts of interest, and you and your team put in the hard work of looking to see how we're doing with this. So Jade, thank you for doing the work to investigate and for joining us to talk about what you found.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's dive right in. In this study, you queried a publicly available database, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Open Payments Database, which is probably better known to many of us as the Sunshine Act database. And you retrieved information on payments from industry to 2,000 authors from randomly selected 2016 articles in five journals. So my first question is, which five journals did you look at?
So we looked at Neurology, JAMA Neurology, The Lancet Neurology, Brain, and Annals of Neurology.
Okay, so really well-known journals to any neurology clinician. And so for those 2,000 authors in those five journals, you characterize the payments those authors received by type. And I'm learning that type is really how this website is organized. So there's three categories: research, general, and associated research institutional. So can you elaborate for us on those three categories? For example, where would consulting for a company show up versus serving on a speaker's bureau versus doing some sort of research? What's the difference between, say, the research category and the associated research institutional category?
Yeah, so the associated research payments, these are payments that are made directly to the institution. So these include research grants and other research funding, like for clinical trials and such. And then research payments, they're also in connection to a research agreement or protocol, but they're paid directly to the individual. So this can include direct compensation. It could also be, you know, funding for research coordination or even payments to study participants and things like that. But the main thing is it's paid directly to the individual. And then the third category, general payments, is similar in that it's also paid directly to the individual, but it's not connected to research. So this is where you would find the consulting fees, travel expenses, food and beverage payments, speaking payments, things like that.
Got it. So if I see $1 million in the general category, that's quite different than $1 million in the associated research institutional category, because the $1 million implies in the general category, it went directly to the practitioner. Whereas if it was in the associated research, it went directly to the institution. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yep.
Okay, so we've got these three categories. And then you also looked at the sponsoring entity and year received between 2013 and 2016. So that's really the time frame of your study. You looked at each author's self-disclosures compared to the open payments database listed industry relationships to measure discordance. This must have been a tremendous amount of work. So then you took it one step further, manually reviewing the payments to identify those from manufacturers of products that were directly tested or discussed in each article of interest. So don't keep us in suspense. How are we doing as a whole in being transparent with our conflicts of interest? What did you find out?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I don't have great news to share on this. We're not doing the best job as a specialty. So in this study, we found that for each of those three payment types, actually over 70% of authors receiving payments did not fully disclose these industry relationships. And that might not be, or I suspect that's not super surprising to a lot of people. You know, there's been a lot of research about underdisclosure of relationships and conflicts of interest. And actually a lot of this underdisclosure could be due to uncertainty in journal policies as well. So there's a lot of variation in journal policies, including the five that we looked at in this project. And it's unclear exactly what relationships authors are required to disclose. So a lot of this underdisclosure might be due to authors not thinking that these relationships are necessarily relevant to the manuscript that they're submitting. So because of that, like you mentioned, we wanted to look specifically at what we considered obviously relevant payments. So we used a narrow definition of relevance for this. We were looking at what we considered obviously relevant payments. So payments from industry to authors who are writing about a drug or device that that company manufactures. And so we found that of the roughly 3,000 directly relevant payments, over 50% were not disclosed by the authors. And that totaled over $5 million. And actually, 90% of the authors had incomplete disclosure of these relevant relationships. So, you know, to put it bluntly, the majority of authors who wrote about a drug or device while receiving payments from the company that makes that drug or device did not voluntarily disclose these relevant payments.
And this is a tremendous problem. So there's a couple things in what you said there. And I've certainly experienced this. Every journal has a different disclosure set up. And many of them use a dollar cutoff. Say they'll say something like, you know, disclose any relationship over $500. Now, when you did your paper, did you have a cutoff? Because I noticed on that website, when I went to it to look myself up, that, you know, there can be entries in there for $10, like meaning like I probably had a meeting to discuss perhaps participating in a trial with a pharmaceutical rep and they bought coffee. So did you include a lower limit or was it all comers? So it could be that in this 70% of inappropriately or underdisclosed things, there are some $10 ones, or did you use a higher cutoff?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So like exactly like you said, I feel like a lot of people will go to, you know, conferences or something, and they'll have an industry entity that's sponsoring a meal, and they're completely unaware of these payments that they're receiving and that are being uploaded onto the Open Payments database. And because they're unaware of it, they aren't reporting it in these manuscripts. So with that in mind, we did take that into account, and we didn't include any relationships with industry entities that only supplied food and beverage payments to the authors. So that's how we accounted for that.
Wow. So even with that accounting, we're still at that 70% number. Okay, good to know. You know, another question I have, you mentioned in your paper that some of these disclosures did not occur. It was a very small subset. You'll have to remind me the number, but did not occur for payments over $1 million. So I've got to know more about this million dollar club. What category were those payments classified under? Again, was it those general payments or was it just really prolific researchers? So I guess I'm saying I hope it was research funding and not just straight, you know, Speakers Bureau. And what percent of this million dollar club, I'll call them, fully disclosed?
Yeah, so that was a shocking thing that we found. There were, I believe, five individuals who received over $1 million annually on average. And there's even one person who received over $5 million one year. So there is definitely this group of neurologists who are receiving exorbitant amounts of money from industry. And yes, luckily, most of this is associated research funding, but not entirely. There was also a handful of authors who averaged over $40,000 in general payments annually. So that's the category that includes the consulting fees, the speaking fees, the direct payments to authors.
Wow, Jade. So you really, you know, it's bad news all around on this, right? Every angle I'm going for here, we're basically just doing a bad job disclosing, right? So tell me the good news. Some people are disclosing and doing it properly?
Yeah, so there's definitely a silver lining. There seems to be a problematic minority. So about half the authors in our sample had no industry relationships, and another 20% received very small compensation, so less than $1,000 a year. So there is that, at least some glimmer of hope on the horizon.
Right. And if we're optimistic, if we're assuming what you said earlier, like some authors really don't even know what does and what doesn't count unless you go to this website. So maybe that's the easy thing to do here, right? Step one is to log on to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Open Payments Database and check, correct? And I did it last night. I just literally typed into Google Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Open Payments, and it pops right up. I dumped my name in there. It was very easy. But one thing that I noticed right away is there are those three categories we talked about, you know, research to the individual, research to the institution, and general payments. But it's really, is it just pharmaceutical companies? Because, you know, I was looking for specific consulting that I had done, you know, to help develop a study at one point, and I didn't see that on there. So is it only pharmaceutical companies on there?
Yeah, so it's pharmaceutical companies. Drug and device manufacturers are included there. But yeah, I would recommend that people do exactly what you did and kind of stalk themselves online on this website, because it's not a perfect system. There sometimes is inaccurate reporting through the Open Payments Database. So industry might overreport some things. They might miss some things, like you said, with consulting. And physicians have the opportunity to dispute some of these relationships if something is incorrect. And I know a couple neurologists who are actually in the process of going through this disputing, and it's a little arduous, but it's definitely good to be aware of, or if you're receiving industry payments and how accurate that is.
You know, from the patient perspective, it's worth knowing this is quite a resource for a patient who's not part of the medical establishment, that you could go on there and perhaps use this as a metric to compare your physicians in terms of determining who's conflicted and would it relate to the question that you're seeking an opinion on from a physician. I would love to see it be a little more clear, I guess. You know, even in searching myself, I was trying to figure out what was falling into what category. And I think it could look to patients like if you participate in a trial, the physician actually earned that income. It's a bit misleading, but it's certainly a great start, I think.
Yeah, and I would like to add now, going off of that, that relationships between industry and physicians are not inherently bad. Like you said, like clinical trials receive a lot of funding from industry, and those are immensely beneficial. So I think the solution here is not to end all collaboration and completely separate from industry. That's just not feasible and not beneficial. So I think the solution is to be transparent about it, and maybe also to have like a healthy skepticism and, you know, recognize the conflicts of interest that come from collaboration, but not assuming that all collaboration necessarily creates bias.
No, absolutely. Certainly the pharmaceutical companies are behind some of the solutions for our patients, but it is a fine line. And this website, I think, helps to allow us to delineate what side of that line any given clinician is falling on. And back to your other point. So yeah, on the journal side, wouldn't it be great if we had a more uniform policy? Or even, wouldn't it be great if the journals under their conflict of interest and disclosure section could have a direct link to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Open Payments and say, hey, take a peek here and make sure that you've included everything that's relevant. That might be a start, right?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a viable option. The key question now becomes, what do we do about this? Now that we know there's all of this under disclosure, how can we be transparent? And I think having journals cross-check their author disclosures with the Open Payments Database is a good idea. But I mean, like I mentioned before, the Open Payments Database is not perfect, and there are some issues that are associated with it.
It's not the source of all conflicts of interest either, but it is certainly a significant one. So can I ask you another question? Out of curiosity, I saw in the paper that you noted that similar data has been queried on other specialties. So how did the failure of neurologists as a whole to report compare to other medical specialties?
Yes, it's definitely not unique to neurologists. We're not alone in this problem of underdisclosure. It's a little difficult to compare our results empirically with other specialties because a lot of the previous studies have looked at the discordance rates for articles, not each individual author. But I can say that in orthopedic surgery articles, cardiac surgery articles, hematology articles, even pulmonology articles, they've all reported over 50% incomplete self-disclosure within articles.
So really, you've identified a significant problem here. You've identified that it's not unique to neurology. And so with that in mind, any other final observations from the data we should be aware of or suggestions that you have, having done all this work?
I think that this information should be considered by policymakers. I think that's the next step here. Like I mentioned before, the question is, what do we do now that we know this is a problem? And I think it remains a very open debate. And actually, the utility of disclosure itself has been called into question. So does disclosure actually mitigate this bias? Or is it just to protect the perceived scientific integrity of the profession, which in itself may be important as well? I don't think disclosure is sufficient to mitigate bias, but I think it's a necessary first step as a way to contextualize the findings of research and allow the reader to really understand all of the elements at play here. So another question is, what is the optimal level of disclosure? Because too many disclosures can be distracting and can actually detract from the relevant ones. There's so many relationships between industry and physicians that it can be overwhelming if someone is listing their 20 conflicts of interest when actually only one of them is relevant and it kind of gets lost in the weeds. Well, underdisclosure obviously has its own issues. So I think that's another thing that needs to be considered as well.
You raise some fantastic points, right, about disclosure. What does the role play? Certainly, though, backing up from that even, we know that it's a problem if we don't even disclose. Then we can't even get to the point of addressing where might the next steps be. But this paper, speaking of first steps, is a fantastic first step to let us know there is a problem. Well, thank you, Jade, for sharing your findings. This has been eye-opening. I think it's a cautionary tale for all of us neurology clinicians to always err on the side of transparency, take the time to be thorough when filling out these disclosure forms, because the consequences of not doing so could be numerous, perhaps greatest of all, losing the trust of our patients. So once again, I've been speaking with Jade Smith about her paper in Neurology This Week, Financial Conflicts of Interest of U.S.-Based Authors in Neurology Journals, Cross-Sectional Study Using the Open Payments Database. Thank you, Jade.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And today we have Emily Largent joining us for our What's Trending segment. Emily is a professor of medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Emily and some of her colleagues at Penn recently co-authored a viewpoint piece in JAMA Neurology published on January 4th titled, "The Future is P-Tau, Anticipating Direct-to-Consumer Alzheimer's Disease Blood Test." And Emily, we are glad to have you joining us today. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
All right. So again, I'm glad you're joining us to talk about this idea of direct-to-consumer testing for Alzheimer's disease. Just a few weeks ago, we had Eric Music from Washington University on to talk about repercussions that we might expect if or when a disease-modifying treatment for Alzheimer's is available. For our audience, that interview aired on March 2nd for any listeners who would like to listen to it as well. So obviously, this topic of patient-driven Alzheimer testing really ties in closely with that one. So as we get started here, just first for some context, are direct-to-consumer tests for phosphorylated tau already available? And if so, how good are they at diagnosing and or prognosticating a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, so direct-to-consumer Alzheimer's disease tests aren't available yet. This was really, to the extent that it's safe, our effort to look into the crystal ball and predict what is around the corner. And so they're not available right now, but I do think they'll be available soon. And I think that there are three key things we have to keep in mind as we think about why that's likely. So the first of those is we just have really exciting science right now suggesting that blood tests can be a very effective way of measuring Alzheimer's disease biomarkers and gathering information about diagnosis and prognosis. And then the second is that there's a regulatory structure that's already in place that allows direct-to-consumer testing. So people are probably familiar with 23andMe and other places you can go to get that kind of direct-to-consumer information if you're interested in knowing what kind of earwax you have or if cilantro tastes soapy. And you don't want to just go buy cilantro, you can ask 23andMe about that. And the third thing that's important is there are already companies that offer direct-to-consumer lab testing. So the blood draw is not an obstacle to a direct-to-consumer test. There are already places you can log in. You can say what you're interested in knowing about yourself. Do you have Lyme disease antibodies? And they will either send someone to your house to draw the labs or they'll order them to a nearby lab. So you can get those lab results without needing to engage with a practitioner in the traditional way of setting up the appointment and going and talking to someone. So altogether, it's not here yet, but I think it'll be here in the near future.
Got it. Yeah. So it sounds like the mechanisms are certainly in place to allow it to happen when it's available. So as we start here, I'd like to read a few sentences from your article. Direct-to-consumer testing reveals the importance individuals place on self-determination. It also expresses disagreements about the propriety of taking testing out of a healthcare professional's hands and placing it in consumers. So I can see both sides of this, right? As a patient, I might say, hey, this is my life. This is my right to know whether I'm going to develop this disease. But on the other hand, I can see potential dangers, right? When I receive information without knowing the context or exactly how to interpret that information that I've been given. So can you help me kind of unpack both sides of this argument?
Sure. So you're exactly right on the patient perspective. People feel that it's their brain, it's their future, and they'd really like to have this information. Survey results suggest very high levels of interest in knowing whether or not you have a risk for Alzheimer's disease. And you know, people use this information in a lot of different ways. So some of it is just preventive behaviors. People who receive information about an Alzheimer's disease biomarker often start to eat more fish and jog more often, and they play brain games and they do things to try to address their risk. And the other set of behaviors they engage in are planning behaviors. So in work that my team has done, we see they revise and update wills. They talk to families about their end-of-life plans and update advance directives. They engage in financial planning. They downsize. They move closer to an adult daughter who might be a caregiver for them in the future. And they make really complicated decisions about work and retirement. So even in the absence of a disease-modifying therapy, which it sounds like you talked about recently, people see a lot of value in just knowing what's coming and being able to control that. At the same time, this is really complex medical information that we're giving. It's not straightforward. And so there's always a worry that people won't be able to understand their results, especially if they aren't placed in context. And we often think that a clinician is in the best position to offer that information.
Yeah. So to that extent, one specific thought I had was what might be, say, mental health repercussions for individuals who pursue testing and they have abnormal test results, and this occurs outside of the typical setting of a doctor-patient relationship. And then kind of a follow-up to that is, have we learned anything, say, from 23andMe or other direct-to-consumer tests and any kind of mental health consequences that direct-to-consumer testing has created?
So there are some people who just don't want to know this information, and that's a lesson we got from 23andMe. There were some people who, early on, before they put it behind multiple protections, logged in and found out they were APOE carriers, for example, and they felt really devastated by that information, and particularly in the case of some parents that they might have passed on to a child. So I think just as a framing issue, when we think about offering something like this, there needs to be good informed consent that patients really know what they're getting, and then there's a check before they get the information. But in terms of once they learn, we know from ongoing studies that have been done with people who are cognitively unimpaired, folks with MCI, that it's generally safe to disclose biomarker information. People are disappointed if they get bad news, but over time they adapt and they accommodate to that information. And we generally don't have safety concerns.
All right. So Emily, what do you see in terms of downstream consequences if direct-to-consumer testing becomes available for phosphorylated tau?
So there are definitely privacy concerns. Oftentimes we see that there are some sales or repackaging of information from direct-to-consumer tests. This happened with 23andMe making their data available to drug companies, for example. So people need to be mindful of that. Other concerns are just related to whether or not once somebody gets a direct-to-consumer test result, that that might affect their ability to get life, long-term care, or disability insurance. There might be housing discrimination if someone wants to move into a long-term care community because they have elevated biomarkers. That would be an extra financial risk to the community, and the community might choose to screen on that. There is also the potential for employment discrimination. And biomarkers are a tricky area because we don't really have robust legal protections for biomarkers the way we do for genes, for example. And even genes, we know the protections are somewhat imperfect. The other broad concern I have is really around stigma. We know that stigma of Alzheimer's disease is a serious and pervasive problem. And some colleagues have conducted survey studies to show that stigma attaches to Alzheimer's disease biomarkers, even in the absence of cognitive impairment, suggesting that people who get a direct-to-consumer Alzheimer's disease blood test result might find that they are now subject to stigma if they disclose that result to others.
So, any other thoughts or anything that we as neurologists should be doing now in light of this information and the potential for these tests becoming available in the near future?
I think my advice is always quite broad, and it's really that we need to be thinking about systemic efforts to reduce the stigma of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, and also to really come up with better resources for patients and their care partners to try to improve the system in which people are receiving information.
Well, terrific. Emily, I encourage our audience to check out your article again. It was written by Emily Largent and her colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, published in JAMA Neurology on January 4th, titled "The Future is p-Tau: Anticipating Direct-to-Consumer Alzheimer's Disease Blood Test." Emily, thanks so much again for your time today.
Thanks very much.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article covering the factors that influence the selection of patients with Tourette syndrome who are eligible for deep brain stimulation surgery, and a study examining the effects of intensive arm motor rehabilitation for patients who are more than 90 days from their stroke. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.